This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levick, WMRA's news director. So glad you're listening. Stay with us on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. Christopher Clymer-Kurtz explores the resources available for students with autism in Virginia. Calvin Penn has a report on what CNN's Jim Acosta had to say at JMU. And Jordy Yeager checks in on a spring break health camp for girls in Charlottesville. We dip into the archives for a look at HPV vaccination rates to find out why they're so low. And we also check in with Jeff Shapiro once again for a look at the week in Virginia politics. But first, several protesters were arrested at a march Wednesday at Cargill in Dayton for trespassing when they tried to deliver a petition in support of workers they say were fired by the company for exercising their rights to organize. Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
Among the nine arrested were an 82-year-old, a young seminary student, and Michael Snell Feikema, a coordinator for the Community Solidarity with Poultry Workers group in Harrisonburg. According to Snell Feikema, several dozen people had gathered on public ground outside of the Cargill plant in Dayton, in part to commemorate the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination.
What King was doing in Memphis has so much in common with this situation here with the poultry workers.
The group also had a petition for Cargill calling for it to reinstate three fired union supporters and to, quote, desist all retaliation against such workers. When some of the group entered Cargill property to deliver that petition, even after being told not to, they were arrested and charged with Class 1 misdemeanors. They were later released. Snell Feikema's concerns extend to the government agencies responsible for protecting workers.
When it comes to Cargill private property, bang, the law is down there right now. But workers can be not getting the treatment they deserve. That can go on for years and years and years, and there's no notice taken.
Cargill, in a statement last night, denied having fired three employees for their union organizing efforts and said protests must be conducted, quote, legally and ethically. For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
On Thursday, CNN White House correspondent and JMU alum Jim Acosta returned to campus as the final Madison Vision Series speaker this year, WMRA's Calvin Penn reports.
Jim Acosta is usually one of the first reporters asking questions when news breaks at the White House, but long before covering the Trump administration for CNN, he studied journalism at James Madison University.
I was part of the student radio station here, WXJM, did a student TV show here over in Harrison Hall. I wrote opinion articles for The Breeze. I ran for student government president at one point, which was probably not the best idea that I ever had.
Acosta addressed around 600 people, many of them journalism and political science students, at JMU's Forbes Center Thursday. His lecture, titled Real News, The Fight for Truth in the 21st Century, emphasized the importance of a free press in the current political climate, as Acosta himself has been on the receiving end of President Donald Trump's fake news accusations on several occasions.
You know, it's uncomfortable to bring it up, and it's uncomfortable to talk about it, but we got to talk about it, because there are journalists out there every day who are doing it for the right reasons. Their heart is in the right place. They may not be perfect every day of the week, but their heart's in the right place because they got into this with a passion, the same passion I came into this with, which is I want to get the news to you, get the truth to you, so you can make informed decisions as part of our democracy.
For WMRA News, I'm Calvin Penn.
Some kids enjoyed their spring break last week, and for some that has meant vegging out or maybe going to visit relatives out of town. But for a group of 13 girls in Charlottesville, it's meant a week-long camp focused on health. WMRA's Jordy Yeager has more.
The camp is put on by the Jefferson Area Children's Health Insurance Program, Sentara Health, and the City of Promise, a cradle-to-career nonprofit that works with hundreds of kids in Charlottesville's oldest continual African-American neighborhood. The 13 girls started the week by taking photos of things they see as assets, friends, family, nature, their communities. Jackie Martin is the director of community benefits for Sentara Martha Jefferson Hospital and a lead organizer of the camp.
So what is well-being? What makes you comfortable? What makes you happy? What encourages good health?
The week is packed with yoga, mindfulness, a trip to see the Black Panther movie, and even a visit to the hospital to learn CPR. For lunch, they head to PB&J Kitchen for cooking skills. And on Wednesday, development coach Kay Monroe paid the girls a visit. She told them there's an inside you and an outside you.
Inside you is the you that we don't see. You don't let us see but so much of that. Matter of fact, you don't look inside enough. Come on now. You spend more time on the outside than you spend thinking about the inside you. But the inside you will manifest on the outside you.
The camp is in its third year, and on Friday, for the first time, the group is headed to D.C. to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
April is National Autism Awareness Month, and for part two of our series, we look at the educational system's approach to students with autism. Christopher Clymer-Kurtz has that story.
Autism spectrum disorder is just that, a spectrum disorder. Each individual, on or off that spectrum, is unique. And so when it comes to educating students with autism, there's no one-size-fits-all option.
There's a little rocking chair that does a little rock and a big rocking chair that does a really big rock.
Beth Davis is an autism teacher at John Wayland Elementary School in Bridgewater.
Squishy things and things that spin.
Her autism classroom serves low-incident, high-needs students in kindergarten through grade 5 from a number of schools in the region.
A swing that's kind of soothing. They got
the Rockingham County School was about to clear out for spring break, but as Davis gave me a tour of her classroom, one of her students came by for a final lesson of the day.
Come in, Ben. No, you're okay. Come in. Well, we're just talking to this man.
Ben and a special education assistant headed to a computer in the corner of the classroom for some math review.
They all have a classroom that they participate with, recess and music and art and all of those special things. They all eat lunch with their peers, and then they come back in here for different parts of the day to do some different work, to build independence or to work on reading or math.
In Virginia, about 20,000 students are eligible for special education services for autism, according to the state's most recent report. While each of them is unique, the disorder causes deficits in three main areas: communication, social interaction, and restrictive and repetitive behaviors, such as body movements or insistence on following routines. Trends in education for students with autism have moved towards including students in mainstream classes and school community activities, teaching self-determination and self-advocacy skills, and basing strategies in applied behavior analysis, or ABA. Doing all that can be challenging.
That's why we have such a strong and large support team in place for our teachers so that they're not having to figure it out on their own.
Kitty Robinson is a board-certified behavior analyst, or BCBA, with Harrisonburg City Public Schools.
We have school psychologists, social workers, BCBAs, instructional coaches, and all of us are there to help support them.
These are all part of a statewide approach that tries to support students and meet their educational needs to prepare them to be productive, more independent community members after finishing school. The Virginia Department of Education works with the Virginia Commonwealth University Autism Center for Excellence and regional training and technical assistance centers to provide professional development and support for teachers. A goal is implementing evidence-based practices identified by the National Professional Development Center on Autism Spectrum Disorder. Those evidence-based practices don't help only students with autism or other disabilities. Any student, with or without disabilities, might benefit from visual supports showing schedules or classroom expectations, or from having additional paraprofessionals or teachers in the classroom. Dan Irwin is Autism, Intellectual Disabilities, and Assistive Technology Specialist with the Virginia Department of Education.
When you start building in some of those specialized supports and those kind of what we would call kind of tier one supports for supporting all students, we do see increases in testing scores.
For students with autism, inclusion in general education classrooms can be beneficial in particular ways.
Students with autism can benefit greatly from being around typically developing peers in the development of communication and social opportunities.
One challenge of providing intensive classroom supports to students is also ensuring that those support systems don't create unhealthy dependencies, such as students needing to be prompted to complete tasks that they have already mastered. Again, Harrisonburg City's Kitty Robinson.
My goal, what I'm thinking every time I encounter a student who needs more specific intervention, is what level of independence are they going to have as a result of this? Because I'm watching the kids grow up before my eyes, and, you know, some of them are going to be graduating high school, and how are they able to advocate for themselves outside of school? Because you really have to have a strong sense of self-determination and self-advocacy to say, like, I have autism, and I need you to do these things for me to be successful.
For Ben, at the computer in his Rockingham County Elementary School classroom, the eventual end of his supportive school career might not be something he's thought about yet. He has math problems to do, after all.
20.
Mm-hmm. 6. Yes, sir. Good job.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Support for WMRA Special Series Autism in Virginia comes from Paul Obaugh, Ford & Lincoln.
a family-owned dealership for more than 50 years, in Stanton on Lee Jackson Highway or at oba.com.
Time now for a look back at a story from last April. HPV infections are leading to an increasing number of cancers in both men and women. There is a vaccine that can address that, but most people in Virginia aren't getting it. In fact, compliance rates for HPV vaccination are so low here and throughout the U.S. that the National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers call it a serious public health threat. WMRA's Emily Richardson-Lorente filed this report last April.
HPV, the human papillomavirus, is a wickedly common sexually transmitted virus. More than 4 out of 5 of us will be infected with it at some point, most without ever knowing it or showing any symptoms. But for an increasing number of Americans, about 31,500 each year, a lingering HPV infection will eventually lead to cancer. And not just any cancer, the cringe-inducing cancers, cervical, vaginal, penile, anal, plus increasingly, cancers in the throat, transmitted through oral sex. The good news is that there is a childhood vaccine that's remarkably effective in preventing these cancers in adulthood. The bad news is that lots of kids aren't getting it.
It's incredibly easy to opt out.
That's Jessica Kime Malpass, an oncology nurse and assistant professor of nursing at the University of Virginia. She's been studying HPV vaccination compliance in the state for a few years now.
I became really interested in this vaccine and this issue in particular because we have been doing just a very poor job of getting our kids vaccinated.
Virginia was actually ahead of the curve when the HPV vaccine was released in 2006. We were, in fact, the first state to make the 3-shot vaccine mandatory for 6th-grade girls. But in the decades since then, our vaccination rate has fallen behind 31 other states. As of 2015, only about 1/3 of Virginia kids were getting fully vaccinated by age 18.
Many people say, what good is having a mandate when it's essentially so easy to get out of it? Does it even really do its job?
In fact, state law says parents can opt out at their sole discretion, no paperwork required. But why do so many parents opt out? Kai Malpass says some parents are just uncomfortable with the idea of vaccinating their little girl or boy against HPV.
Parents assumed that because this vaccine is targeted to HPV, which is in fact a sexually transmitted infection, it may promote sexual debut.
Sexual debut may not be a term you or I have ever used, but you get what she's saying, right? It's spooky to think about this stuff with your 11-year-old. But research has shown that vaccination does not lead to early sexual debut.
The whole reason that the vaccine works is that we are targeting boys and girls before they have sexual encounters, and we know that it works better when we get them at that young age.
In fact, children ages 11 to 14 react so well to the vaccine that the CDC recently reduced the number of shots required at those ages from 3 to just 2. Of course, for some parents, the number of shots is a moot point, because they just don't trust vaccines, to which Kime Malpass says,
now that the vaccine has been out for 10 years, we know that it's really effective at preventing devastating cancers, and we know that it's safe.
Vaccine skepticism and parental squeamishness may not be easy obstacles to overcome, but Kime Malpass identified one change that could make a big difference. The doctor's delivery.
If the provider has hesitation about the recommendation, then we know that that leads to hesitation on the parent end as well.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
That's Charlottesville pediatrician Emily Wong.
We have found in our own office that when we gave a better recommendation, there was a lot better uptake of the vaccine than we had expected.
A year ago, Dr. Wong and her colleagues realized they were presenting the Tdap and meningococcal vaccines as mandatory to parents of 6th graders, and the HPV vaccine as effectively optional, because after all, skipping the vaccine wouldn't bar their kids from school.
And when we presented it like that, well, no one would choose the optional vaccine. And when we think about what we're trying to prevent, I think that's the most important thing, that we recognize we're trying to prevent cancer. And there are very few things that we have to prevent cancer.
Initially, the CDC recommended the HPV vaccine only for girls, primarily to prevent cervical cancer, which kills about 4,200 women a year in the U.S. Boys weren't added to the CDC's recommendation until 5 years later.
In the beginning, they thought, oh, we're just vaccinating the boys because we're trying to protect the girls. But now that we realize there is a growing number of oropharyngeal cancer in males.
Those are cancers in the throat, at the base of the tongue or the tonsil.
Parents of boys have become more receptive as well.
And you trust the HPV vaccine?
Yes, I've had it administered to my own child. All right, Madeline. Well, it's been 15 minutes since your shot. How are you feeling?
I feel all right.
Okay, great. Well, you're free to go then. And just remember that you need to have a second shot after 6 months. All right?
All right.
If every child received their HPV vaccination on schedule, that could prevent up to 90% of HPV-related cancers down the road, according to the American Cancer Society. That's an awful lot of adults who won't get cancer and won't have to wonder if a childhood vaccine could have prevented it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
And finally today, let's get some perspective on Virginia politics with Richmond Times-Dispatch political columnist Jeff Shapiro. He sat down for a conversation Friday morning with Soraya Wintersmith at our partner station WCVE.
Our first item this morning is actually a bit of a look ahead. Virginia lawmakers are going to return next week to try to work out a budget. Jeff, they couldn't get together over Medicaid expansion the first time. Where do things stand now?
This do-over, I suspect, is going to take a good deal of time. The legislature is coming back into session on Wednesday, that's the 11th, called back by Governor Northam, who is determined to see that Medicaid expansion is implemented. The real deadline, the really serious deadline, of course, is June 30th, when the current spending cycle ends. But a lot of local governments and other entities that rely on the state's largesse are making it very clear that they would like the state to act soon. This does not seem to have created an enormous sense of urgency for the legislators, particularly on the matter of Medicaid expansion. The House, which of course had strenuously opposed expansion during the McAuliffe years, now supports it. The Senate is adamantly opposed, so we're told, though the Senate Republican caucus, the majority caucus, includes at least one member who is likely to support expansion at some point and in some form, still undetermined.
Next up, a pair of actions by Governor Ralph Northam has the environmental sphere abuzz. On Monday, he reappointed David Paler as the head of the Department of Environmental Quality. And on Tuesday, he signed an executive order which kind of cracks the whip at this highly criticized agency.
And I would argue that these are actions that need to be viewed as one. David Paler is clearly generating a good deal of concern among Democratic Greens, large G Greens, if you will, the environmental left. This is spotlighting a continuing problem for Governor Northam, and that is this suspicion of his environmental credentials by the environmental left. It is particularly incensed by the continuing sway of Dominion Energy. Northam, who fancies himself an environmentally conscious Democrat, signed this executive order, commits the state to full enforcement of environmental laws, but it largely appears designed to calm his critics, at least among clean air, clean water, and clean soil advocates.
Also this week, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring has joined a lawsuit that seeks to block the Trump administration from inquiring about citizenship on the upcoming census. Jeff, what do we know about this lawsuit, and what does Virginia's inclusion mean?
This is a federal action, and Virginia would be among 18 states and 6 cities pushing this litigation, challenging this question for the 2020 headcount. It is the contention of Attorney General Herring and others, most notably Democrats, that this question is intended only to frighten illegal immigrants, and that it would diminish the accuracy of the headcount. And, of course, if that is not accurate, it could have profound consequences for how the federal budget is sliced and, of course, how seats are determined in the U.S. House of Representatives. There is a larger element to this matter, and it is Virginia-specific, and that is this is a reminder that Virginia is increasingly multi-hued, and that, of course, is contributing to the large D Democratic ascendancy in this state, the evidence of which is last November's Democratic sweep and the big gains the party made for the House of Delegates.
And finally, U.S. Senator from Virginia Tim Kaine has officially launched his reelection bid. Jeff, quite a bit has happened since the first time the junior senator ran for the seat.
And, of course, that includes running for vice president of the United States in 2016, a race he lost. Among the more interesting aspects of this continuing Kaine kickoff, he's been traveling the state. He has been spotlighting the importance of jobs and economy, but to some degree crediting Trump for harnessing the importance of those issues in 2016. Kaine, of course, is not just looking for a win, but a big win to make up for that big loss 2 years ago. The Republicans are facing long odds to take back the Kaine-held seat. However, they have approved three prospective candidates for their primary ballot. That includes Corey Stewart, the Trump sound-alike, Nick Freitas, a relatively new delegate from the horse country of Virginia, who caused quite a stir with some of his more provocative remarks about Democrats and race and other hot-button issues in a widely reported floor speech, and then E.W. Jackson, who was the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor in 2013 and was soundly defeated by the man who would go on to become governor in 2017, Ralph Northam.
Jeff Shapiro, our time is up. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Soraya. Good weekend to you.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. All our stories are archived at WMRA.org. If you'd like to support our ability to produce them, go to that website, Mouse Over News, then click on News and Information Fund. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. Follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. In the meantime, to get a daily local news update on your smartphone every weekday morning, subscribe to our newscast, the WMRA Daily, and it'll just pop right up there. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.